The first reading comes from what scholars call Treto Isaiah, that is chapters 56 and 66 in the scroll of Yeshayahu or Isaiah, which we now know was written by three different authors over a period of 100 years and then put together later. This third and latest section is often considered to be the most poetic in its critique of society in 520 years before the beginning of our era. Or when you listen to it, you may think it's 2012 he's talking about. We do not know the author's name.
To all appearances, you are a nation busy, busy, busy at worship. You go about bragging that you are law-abiding and God-fearing, yet there you are, driving your employees much too hard. Your bottom line always seems to be craftily gained profit. You engage in your moving religious rituals, but then you also bicker and fight amongst yourselves as if they mean nothing. Listen, worship is fine, but this is the kind of religious celebration I'm after: to break the chains of injustice, to get rid of exploitation in the workplace, to free the oppressed, and to cancel their debts so they can finally move forward. I am interested in you sharing your food with the hungry, inviting the homeless into actual homes, maybe your own, putting clothes on the shivering ill-clad, and yes, being available to your own families as well. Do all this, and the lights will turn on in the gloom of the times, and your lives will be turned around at once. If you get rid of unfair practices, blaming victims, or gossiping about other people's mistakes, if you are generous with the hungry and start sharing yourselves with the down and out, your lives will be bathed in sunlight. Your shadows will vanish. Your actions will pave the path before you.
The second reading comes from the most recent issue of Street Speech, the paper that many of Columbus's homeless sell on the street, especially downtown, I think. They pay 25 cents per issue and sell it for a dollar, although many give more. I often find the articles inspiring and informative, moving, educational, well-written, and prophetic. And I urge those of you who work downtown to always seek out the woman or man standing on the corner so that you too may purchase one. The author of this particular article is Catherine Carroll.
At a coffee shop in the short north, a man starts falling asleep in his chair, nodding off over a cup of coffee. I recognize him as a regular panhandler in the area. It's cold outside, and I wonder where he slept, or if he slept at all. Twice in 10 minutes he is told that he cannot sleep there. He must wake up or leave. I closed my eyes in sympathy. Surely they would not feel so comfortable asking the same of me. Though I often dress like a hobo, I'm a regular, and it's reasonably obvious that I'm economically privileged. If you do not have a home, and if you do not have money either, where can you go? In Columbus, since April of 2010, when records were first kept, up to 66 people have been turned away from shelters every night because there is no room. This number may in fact be much higher, as those who do not qualify for shelter are not counted. Though extra beds are added in the winter, this does not guarantee access. There are those who, for a number of reasons, rarely make it into shelters at all. The Columbus shelter system turned away 13% of single adults seeking shelter through diversion in 2009. This year, new policies require shelters to divert 30% of those who seek to stay there. Though the intent is to divert individuals to other resources or to stay with friends and family, most people go to shelters as a last resort, and many may end up on the streets or in an otherwise unsafe situation. Where can one sleep in the absence of money or the good fortune of supportive family and friends, if not the shelter? Legally, nowhere. Poverty is systemic. It results from social and economic policies. Rising poverty and homelessness have coincided with cuts to low-income housing subsidies in the early 1980s, funding for mental health and education, and increases in government funding on law enforcement and prisons. There is no secret to lowering poverty rates. They were lowered in the 1970s as a result of social programs, and most Western democracies continue to have much lower poverty rates than the United States. The official poverty rate rose to 15.1% in 2010, and census data reveals that almost half of all Americans live beneath 200% of the poverty level. Meanwhile, the richest 5% of the population own about 62% of privately held wealth in the United States, while the bottom 80% of the population only hold 15% of the wealth, according to studies by Edward Wolf, an economist at New York University. Rather than providing adequate support to make up for poverty and inequality by providing jobs, income, housing, or equal educational opportunities, governments have ignored or rationalized the circumstances that they have helped to create through neglect by individualizing its causes and encouraging our national culture of blaming the victim.
This month, the themes circle around the word brokenness. And I'd like to suggest in this sermon this morning that the brokenness is certainly about broken lives when we're talking about homelessness, but it's also about broken hearts. And since I'm preaching, I'll talk about my own. A couple of years ago, I was part of a community memorial service down at Trinity Episcopal Church, right across from the State House. Ministers, priests, rabbis, pastors, and imams all joined together to remember all the homeless folks in Columbus who had died in the past year. We rose and we spoke their names. We lit candles to sign the inherent dignity of their lives. There were a couple of folks who spoke before me, clergy, social workers, so forth. When it was my turn to speak, I started out like this. And this whole speech that I gave was printed in Street Speech back in January. When I lead a memorial celebration at the congregation I am privileged to serve, I open the service with the same ritual every single time. I put the words into the order of service so that people of any beliefs and no beliefs can recite them together in a moment of unity. The words are simple and insightful. They were written by J. Donald Johnston, a Unitarian Universalist minister, many decades ago. In the presence of life, we say no to death. In the presence of death, we say yes to life. Earlier today, I continued in the Trinity pulpit, we were in the presence of death. We named the names of homeless people who have died. I was deeply moved, even though I knew none of these people personally. But I do know people who are homeless and who are still living, and thus I especially now want to find a way to say yes to life. I was glad to be part of that service down at Trinity for many reasons. I live in a comfortable loft downtown, my home, but those without homes have never been far from me my entire life. I see homeless people every single day when I am downtown on my way home, late at night, midday, makes no difference. Often if I am walking, I try to greet homeless people selling street speech on the corners as people, as human beings, and not some example of the category them. For example, I buy the street speech whenever I can. When I'm entering the North Market, when I'm walking downtown, I give people a couple of bucks or five or ten. Lately, I've been trying to be consistent and buying copies from a fellow named William that I talked to one day and found him to be a delightful human being, 20-something, well-groomed, rather clever at computers, he says, and since he designs all of the word games in street speech, I have to believe him. He carries his whole life in a backpack the size of a small Volkswagen on his back. I stop to talk with him a few minutes every single time, trying not to get in the way of his sales, to find out how his life is going. He works the night shift at a Sunoco station on South High, and doesn't make enough doing that for both rent and food together. That's surprising. I haven't seen him in the last few weeks, but I know he's still producing word puzzles for street speech, so he's out there somewhere. For many years, my friend Warren, who I've mentioned a number of times, lived in the Volunteers of America shelter or at Faith Mission in between apartments, and he did have a home of his own now and then. a felon early in his youth, it's difficult for him to find good work or any work. Despite his admirable work skills, I've watched him work. He's really good. Because when you have a record, it follows you like a shadow for the rest of your life, and there's nothing you can do about it. Only one temp agency was able to get him work, and he worked on and off through that temp agency before he moved to Pittsburgh 2 weeks ago to try out his luck in a different state. I often used to drive him back to the shelter from his temp factory job because the buses don't run in Columbus very late. And he used to get out at 11 p.m. at the factory where he worked, and the buses weren't running then. What's a person to do? My friend McCoy lived in the shell of a camper trailer in his grandmother's backyard for many years. He's been looking for work for years, and I did help him to find a job. He did very well at that job. He was a checker for Giant Eagle. Best checkout clerk Giant Eagle ever had, I heard his boss say one day when he didn't know I was listening. After a few months, his boss had to let him go because no one ever told McCoy when he was growing up that there is a central merchant truth in the world, and that is the customer is always right. In the trailer home in which he was raised, if someone tried to con you in some way, you resisted in no uncertain terms with clear, loud naming of the injustice. But you really can't do that at Giant Eagle. When several customers tried to pull a fast one on him, I was a bank teller once, so I know what fast ones are. Assuming he was like in some kind of cashier trance and wouldn't notice, he refused to get in, and he named what was going on aloud and very clearly. I understand that sense of justice very well. But how is a person who was raised in an environment so at odds with the merchant world of modern America supposed to learn these difficult lessons before he's fired? There's no classes. He lived for a long time on food stamps, about 90 bucks per week. He used to drink and do drugs when he was younger, on his own, mind you, not even with a 12-step program. 6 years ago, he stopped it all. He used to have a gambling addiction, stopped it all, doesn't do anything anymore. You can offer him anything, a glass of wine with dinner, he's not going to take it. You would think that might count for something in this world. It apparently doesn't. My old friend Todd used to live in his storage unit downtown. Fortunately, the storage unit people knew about it and didn't seem to mind, even though it was illegal to do so. So he was safe in the winter storms for a while. Todd suffers from a form of mental illness. He's smart as a tack, observant, but has almost no impulse control, if you know what I mean. I met him in a cafe one day when he sat down at my table, which had the only empty chair in the place. And we talked, and I've kept up communication with him. I've had him to my house for dinner a number of times. He tried to get into homeless programs that might help him stay at a permanent place, but he was never qualified enough, whatever that means. I would think that mental illness and living in a storage unit would be qualification enough. But apparently I'm wrong. Last year, after his mother died up in Toledo, he left Ohio and he moved to Texas, where he was actually able to get into a program that houses him not too far from Dallas. We still talk on the phone now and then. He seems to be doing pretty well. Lives on next to nothing, but he's not starving. And he has a roof over his head, and he even has a computer. No internet, but a computer. My impression is that society would be glad if all these folks would just go away, as if they were an embarrassment. I'm not alone in thinking this, I think. The great poet of the homeless, Julia Vinograd of Berkeley, California, whom I've quoted before, puts it this way. And since I used Anatole France's ironic statement as an affirmation, I think I'm going to use Julia Vinograd's ironic poem right here in the middle of my sermon. The title is, "The Homeless Are Our Dirty Underwear." We've got to get the tired men pushing broken shopping carts, the waddling bag ladies with plastic-flowered raincoats, and the skinny young kids spare-changing dog food for their dog and all her nuzzling puppies off the street. Off the street before the bombs fall. Oh, I can't explain the connection, but I seem to remember, suppose you were run over by a truck, and when they undressed you in the morgue and you were wearing that dirty underwear in front of everyone, wouldn't you just die of shame? So when the bombs fall, everyone must be wearing clean underwear, good clothes, looking well-fed and happily married in houses with gardens and swings for the children, even when it's not true. Hell, especially when it's not true. It's a matter of patriotism, after all. We have to suffer to look good enough for death, like dressing for a job. The homeless weren't American enough to live, and they're certainly not American enough to die. They're such an embarrassment. Suppose the world ends, and there's still broken shopping carts in ruined cities. Suppose the broken shopping carts never, ever go away. Will they ever go away? In America? I'm not so sure. There would have to be more changes in our nation than building a couple more faith missions. America, you see, has different classes of people, classes who do not share the same description. Some have lots of money and privilege. Some have some, and some have none. And yet all supposedly are equal citizens of the same country. Some own the table, some are allowed at the table, and some are told to just keep away from the table. The homeless, insists Julia Vinograd in her sarcastic poem, are simply not welcome at the table. They are an embarrassment to those who live in a different class, people with homes and maybe better luck. It's a question of patriotism, she ruefully adds. I can only shake my head that anyone has to write a poem like this. But they do. A writer from Street Speech, Catherine Carroll, tells us that in Columbus, Ohio, as in many other American cities, if the homeless cannot get into a shelter or the home of a friend, and at least 60 per night cannot, they are going to have to break the law because nothing they choose to do will be legal. This is the most concrete way of saying go away that I can think of, and frankly, it embarrasses me and it breaks my heart. I admire what Michelle Miles said this morning. Her affection for Dawson kept her out of shelters where dogs that people love are not welcome. She also courageously brought up her own fight with depression, which is something so many sweep under the rug or feel embarrassed to bring up. I, on the other hand, think that not bringing it up and its relationship to some homelessness and social inequities in our city and nation is sheer cowardice and very destructive to the body politic of our great nation. The 58th chapter in the book of Isaiah was written by another social poet like Julia Vinograd 2,500 years ago. These verses suggest quite clearly that homelessness is not a new phenomenon, but something that has been going on for a very long time. The author also suggests that homelessness is tied up with other issues, injustice in the workplace and oppression of certain groups in society, our banking practices. Not many banking institutions I can think of will follow Isaiah's advice and simply cancel debts. Clearly, the fight to include all people in the human family has been going on for millennia. Anatole France pointed out in 1994 that homelessness was rife in Paris, people sleeping under bridges and all. My neighbor in Oakland, Oliver, became homeless, and he used to sleep under bridges too, unless I let him sleep on my couch on rainy nights. That was 20 years ago. That homelessness has threaded through history is not, I think, however, a reason for despair or to give up. It's only a reminder to keep at it, for the present reality is simply intolerable to anyone who hasn't got themselves drunk on the hardest nails, take care of your own life first, and to hell with everyone else, philosophy lifted up by preachers like Ayn Rand. Like I said, those without homes have been a part of my life for decades. My acquaintance Devere was temporarily homeless and needed a place to stay immediately, and so I put him up in my place, and he stayed for 2 years until he moved to Atlanta. We became the best of friends and improved each other's lives immensely, despite our differences in just about everything. He changed my life in 1,000 ways, and I changed his. And I know, you're right. I have no children at home to worry about, and so can risk doing things that Isaiah 58 suggests. I hardly think it's wisdom for everyone to be doing what I'm doing. But I know I have been changed for the better by the risks I've taken. And I've also engaged the homeless without taking risks. When my friend Kev was homeless and trying to live in an abandoned bus in a junkyard out in Oakland, California, he kept on giving me his beautiful watercolors, which he painted every day. I was grateful, but I refused to take them unless I paid for them. I knew from talking to him that he was wrestling with issues of shame, and that by actually paying for his art and paying him well, I could prevent that shame from shaping his every single moment. He now has a good place to live and flies all over the world for his work, by the way. So homelessness does not have to stay forever. And I've heard some amazing, heartwarming stories associated with homelessness. My friend Eric S., for example, who was homeless for a while in Los Angeles, told me recently that when he was sponging, know that word? I didn't. Nice new word for your Scrabble boards. Sponging is when somebody holds up a sign saying, this is what I need. This is what I'm looking for. You see them all the time. He was sponging. He was approached by a woman who claimed to be an artist who was working in large collage-like pieces of art. Eric, quite hungry, was holding up a sign that said, Visions of a Cheeseburger. The artist asked him to sell his sign to her so she could put it in her very next work of art, which was going to be about homelessness. She paid him handsomely for it. I know that also not everyone has had my experiences or heard stories like I've been telling. Some people tell me they are frightened of folks wrapped in tarry clothes, demonstrating some aspect, often, of mental illness, or smelling of malt liquor, or evidencing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. Many veterans, male and female, suffer this deeply hurtful malady, you know, not surprising to me. Of the 3,500,000 homeless in America in any recent given year, a whole 15% are veterans. It makes me just want to shake the next person I see with a sign saying, support the troops. Well, maybe not until you support them when they come home, Mr. Self-Anointed Patriot. I'm not the only one involved with homeless people personally. As I learned the hard way back at the Trinity Memorial Service, we are all involved whether we imagine so or not. We had lit candles in memory, whether we knew their names or not. And as I often say as a summary of my basic religious idea, each of the lives of the homeless people are just as important to them as my life is to me. And that spiritual assertion alone connects all of us to the homeless in the United States, in Columbus, all around the world. And also we're involved because no one has a right, at least I don't see it in the Constitution, to own the table and keep others away from it. People claim that right, but they don't have the legal right to do so. The fact that the Supreme Court made corporations persons doesn't give them the legal right either, even though corporations like Monsanto seem to have no shame at all in trying to claim the whole world's food supply for themselves. Every seed on every farm. Unbelievable. So to truly memorialize the homeless, we have other things to do besides lighting candles. We have to find a way to say no to more deaths on the street. The Obama administration is trying to get all veterans off the street by 2015. We could start there by supporting him in any way we can. We could offer to drive food down to Faith Mission when we have time in the afternoon on the two Fridays a month when we cook for Faith Mission. There are so many more ways to say, in the presence of death, we say yes to life. In the presence of death, we say yes to life. In the presence of death, we say yes to life.